what I've sort of gradually learned and experienced myself trying to practice, trying to understand, trying to reflect on the teachings, on the material, and trying to meditate on it, trying to really sort of realize it and get the perspective that's been recommended, which is a very long process, of course.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Today on In Good Faith, we continue a mini-series we're doing on translation of holy texts. I'm here with senior producer Heather Bigley.
Hello.
And we've heard previously from Tremper Longman, a senior translator of the New Living Translation, and John Ross, executive director of the St. John's Bible Heritage Program in Collegeville, Minnesota. And upcoming, we'll hear from Alan Christensen, translator of the ancient Mayan text, the Popol Vuh, or if we can try and say how that Popol Vuh. We'll learn together.
Yes.
But today we're hearing an interview with John Conti. And Heather, what's his connection with translation?
So John Conti actually translates Buddhist texts out of the Tibetan canon. And that's a whole bunch of different moving parts that he'll explain to us. He's been translating for most of his life, even though he went to college and even practiced as a medical doctor for a while. So parents, they can do both things, both their passion and the smart thing. He's a founding member of what's called the Padmakara Translation Group, a Tassadra Foundation Fellow from 2001 to 2012, and was awarded the 2016 Hiensei Foundation Fellowship. In 2009, he was appointed editorial chair of www.84000.co, which is a translation and publication venue for the Tibetan Buddhist canon, and he became senior editor in 2023. So he's going to explain what that 84,000 number means to us right now.
It's very commonly said that there are 84,000 different negative mind states, and there are 84,000 teachings that the Buddha gave to combat them. And the negative mind states are kind of classified into what's sometimes called the three poisons. So attachment, aversion, and ignorance.
That feels like an indictment right there. Just
it's something we all have as a sort of primitive instincts, you know, that guide how we defend ourselves. And, you know, we need to do that, but take them too far and they become an impediment to awakening and understanding how things really are. Within those three broad categories, there are said to be 21,000 related to attachment, 21,000 related to aversion, which of course includes fear and hate and anger and all of those things, and 21,000 related to ignorance or confusion or, you know, just getting things wrong. And there are other ways where you can break it down further. And there are some quite detailed explanations of how the various different mental states that one can generate are sort of antidotes to them. But it's not something that actually anybody sits down to count.
But at the same time, and seems in fact, there's a pragmatism to it, right?
This is one of the things that first really attracted me to Buddhist study. I was brought up as a Christian in the, you know, British Anglican Church. I found the difficulty was about belief. You either had it or you didn't. You believed in God or you didn't. And when I first came across Buddhists of different traditions, I very much got the impression this is practical, something you do. It's like growing a crop or cooking. You know, there's a recipe. You sit down and you do this and then you do that and then you do this. And then when you got to that point, you do something else. It's very, yeah, pragmatic.
And a building of skill and an investment that pays, you know, dividends, especially if you think of things like breathing exercises or stilling your mind, the more you do, the better you become, the more effective it is, right? That kind of thing
exactly.
Is incredibly reassuring and helpful.
Yes. Almost anybody can start somewhere and start to look inwards at the mind a bit. And if you can't do that, then you can start by trying to at least sit still. And, you know, or if you can't do that, at least you can breathe, because we can all do that. So there's lots of ways in. And I found that very, I suppose, reassuring, but also very, you know, gave an easy way in. And I never looked back, actually.
I think for our listeners, they're never going to have heard before, most of them probably, of the Kangyur and Tengyur. And so if you could explain what that is, and even a basic thing, like what language is that written in? What languages did you have to learn in order to translate them?
Yes, absolutely. And to sort of answer your question on the basics, the Buddhist canon, there's not one single canon of all the texts. So we have the sort of essential Buddhist texts, which are said to be the words of the Buddha in several different languages. And there's the Pali canon, which is very well known and was the first one that Westerners explored and came into contact with, that's in the language Pali, which is an Indic language, said to be sometimes a Prakrit, which is a more widely used version of Sanskrit, which is a kind of classical Indian language, a bit like, you know, Latin or Greek, and was the language of learning. Pali was more of a sort of spoken language. Then we have the text in Sanskrit itself, when they became to be written down and made into slightly more classical literature. And then there were the canons that came from the translations. And so the first language that these Indian scriptures were translated into was Chinese, probably starting from the first century AD. And then considerably later, really only starting in the 7th, 8th centuries, texts began to be translated from these Indian languages into Tibetan. And, you know, Tibet is not very far from the northern Indian centers of learning. And especially in that time, there were these great Buddhist universities in northern India, Nalanda, Vikramashila, and Udantapuri, in the sort of area that we now call Bihar and all along the Ganges Valley, really. And Tibet is just over the mountains, but of course there is a big geographical barrier. But what was happening is that Tibetans were somehow getting interested in Buddhism, and with the support of their emperor, who was very powerful at the time, he began to come and study in India. The Tibetan translations came later, between the 7th and perhaps the early 9th century, where there was a huge sort of nationally sponsored project to translate all the available scriptures from Sanskrit into Tibetan. And then soon after that, you get a lot of change going on in India, and perhaps especially the arrival of the Mughals and the Muslim invaders and Turkic peoples coming down from the northwest. You know, sometimes it's said that they sort of destroyed Buddhism and a lot of the monasteries. It may be that there was more going on than that. Buddhism was perhaps losing the all-important sponsorship that was necessary to maintain large monastic institutions and so forth. But Buddhism almost disappeared from India from about the 12th, 13th centuries. And the Tibetan translations represent a kind of snapshot sample of all of that literature that was almost literally frozen, taken to Tibet and maintained for a millennium, you know, without much change. So we have Pali, we have Chinese, and we have Tibetan. Those are the three main canons.
So you ended up having to learn Tibetan. Is that what I'm gathering?
Nobody forced me to.
So you had the privilege of learning Tibetan. But
yes, my main contacts eventually were with Tibetan Buddhist teachers. And so I learned Tibetan gradually. I didn't really sort of say I'm going to be a translator. It was more that, you know, I was involved in studying and practicing this, all of this material, and we had to try and understand it. We were getting explanations and oral teachings, but we also wanted to get down to the texts and, you know, really see what they were.
Yeah. So I've heard a couple of things, these kind of aphorisms maybe. One is that translation, you know, is a betrayal. I've heard that translation is interpretation. I've heard that translation is commentary. As a translator, what do you think of, or how do you kind of think of the work that you're doing?
I and most translators I know, we always feel a little bit uncomfortable and inadequate, you know, because these texts are very detailed in many cases and very profound. And you've always got the idea that somehow by putting them into English, something might be missing. You know, you might not have really understood, or you might not be able to convey in English some of the ideas that are being expressed. There's, of course, a big problem of terminology, because our vocabulary in English for some of these subtle states of mind and perception and so forth are not necessarily easy to translate. And, you know, how do you make the difference between one term and another, even if you know that in Tibetan or in Sanskrit they have quite distinct meanings? I think it's been very encouraging for us all just to study what, you know, Western academics have made of translation theory, which is the idea that actually any translation is a new creation. So on the one hand, that is a little bit more comfortable, but on the other hand, gives you more responsibility. And obviously the whole art of kind of translation that we're doing is to stay as accurate and faithful as possible to the original, but also it has to communicate, it has to mean something to readers. So you're translating the words, you're translating a text, but it's also a cultural transfer, it's a cultural transmission. You're changing ideas and concepts which hardly exist in our world and trying to make them accessible without losing too much.
Yeah.
So I was still kind of explaining about the Kanjur and Tenjur. And of course, these are canonical scriptures. The Kanjur is supposed to be the scriptures that actually record the teachings that the Buddha himself gave. Or if not the Buddha, then people very close to the Buddha sort of speaking under his inspiration. But these are the sort of words that are the foundation of the whole edifice. And then the Tenjur is the Tibetan collection of teachings and writings from the great scholars of Buddhist India who are held in very high esteem and who wrote these extraordinary works on all kinds of topics, but mainly, you know, on how to interpret the Buddha's teachings. So these are two very big collections. The Kanjur is 102, 103 volumes, depending on the version. There are several different Kanjurs, and the Tenjur is about twice as big, so a bit more than 200 volumes. So we're talking about, you know, 300 massive books, which are in the form of, you know, because they were printed using planks of wood, basically with the writing carved on them. So they're kind of long things, the shape of a plank of wood, printed on both sides. And I guess in one of those Kanjur volumes, you could get, if you look at a sort of average Western-style paperback, you could get maybe 20 books out of one volume.
It seems like that would make it eternal, right? Like it's not going anywhere. The ink is not going to fade on that, right? Because it's carved into the...
The printing technology was kind of simple in a way, but very carefully done. You know, it was involved preparing the wood very carefully, finding the right kind of wood. And then you have these very skilled carvers who would be carving in a mirror image, of course, because it has to be, you know, like a negative in, for a film. And then they roll ink onto the wood and then put a piece of paper and roll a roller over it so that all parts of the letters get printed. Wow. But yes, there's lots and lots of these huge libraries full of these, what we call in technical terms, a xylograph, meaning a wood block print. Mm. And of course, this was a contrast to the way that the texts were brought to Tibet. Sanskrit texts were brought to Tibet from India, most commonly on palm leaves and sometimes on birch bark. Again, the same sort of shape, but a little bit smaller, and they would be manuscripts, people calligraphing the books on them.
When I hear you talk about this, I'm just struck by how important these words were to these people. The investment in time, in developing the skill, in developing the technology, in order to make sure that these words are preserved and heard by so many people. And you're part of that. Your translation efforts is, you know, generations later, centuries later, is part of that intense reverence for these sacred texts.
Yes, well, it's a kind of continuation of the same thing. Of course, we have our modern technologies, which make things a lot easier.
God bless Gutenberg.
But yes, these being the canonical texts, they were held with huge reverence. There's this whole idea in transmission that there's a whole ethics of transmission. So if you're talking about the Kanjur or even the Tenjur, these are works that were very carefully translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan. You know, the whole idea of going all the way back to the Buddha himself was that nobody would dream of putting their own thoughts in. You have to understand as best you can, you have to transmit it, but you stick to what was there and you make sure that is what gets handed on to the next generation. Another thing I should perhaps mention, of course, is that, you know, all of this literature was for several centuries after the Buddha's lifetime was oral, and people would be trained to be reciters and they would learn all of these scriptures by heart or as many as they could. And then they would have systems, you know, where the communities would get together and people would recite what they'd remembered and other people would check, you know, that what they'd remembered was correct and all of that. And it was, I suppose, again, about the sort of first century AD, around the time of Christ, that the text began to be written down, whether in Pali or in Sanskrit or whatever it might be.
I do want to ask a follow-up question about the transference from Pali to Sanskrit. The way I'm interpreting that in my brain is it went from something that was a little more colloquial and a little more sort of the parlance of the average person to something that is a little more formal and raised. Am I misinterpreting that? Or
in some ways, no. But the way that we as Western historians have seen this has changed, especially over the last 40, 50 years, I suppose. You know, in the beginning, when Westerners first came across Pali, they sort of took it as the Pali Buddhists had sort of presented it as being the kind of the original early teachings of the Buddha that were later sort of formalized in Sanskrit. But it's not really how it happened. In fact, the Pali texts are not any older than the Sanskrit texts. The different Buddhist communities in India sort of divided, and they had different ideas and different interpretations, particularly about the monastic rules. So what tended to happen was that especially towards the south, there were people who preserved the literature in Pali when it was written down. The difference between Pali and Sanskrit is not enormous. It's a little bit like perhaps the difference between Spanish and Italian or something like that, or maybe even less. The words are recognizably the same. They just have slightly different spelling. So there's not a huge difference, but the two languages coexisted.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. In our BYU Radio family of podcasts, I've got to tell you about an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. Are you ready to immerse yourself in the awe-inspiring world of nature? That's what Constant Wonder does. Host Marcus Smith brings us on trips and conversations with people whose lives have been touched by the beauty of the earth and exploring its mysteries. If you crave some adventure and you want to travel the earth, but it's hard to fit into your schedule, do what I do and listen to Constant Wonder, riveting conversation with individuals whose lives have been impacted and changed by their explorations of the Earth's beauty and its mysteries. Constant Wonder, wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with John Conte about translation of the Buddhist Tibetan canon.
Let's dive in. You were studying medicine and anthropology at Cambridge, and this is where you actually come across Buddhism for the first time. You decide to, instead of, you know, practicing medicine, you're going to actually go into translation. Like, this is a fascinating story. Will you share that with us? I would love to know what drew you to Buddhism and what then drew you to change sort of your professional plans.
I went to Cambridge University to study medicine. And we were all sort of mixed in, not just medical students, but mixed in with other people. In my college, my neighbor was somebody who had come to study Sanskrit and Pali, and he'd been on a sort of gap year to India and Nepal and met some Tibetans and, you know, was very keen on it. It was thanks to him that I got interested in Buddhism, but I continued to study medicine. We had a very interesting group in Cambridge of a sort of university Buddhist group, and we had guests from all kinds of Buddhist traditions coming to give talks, and I got quite involved with, you know, helping to run it and invite people and so forth. After 3 years in Cambridge, went to London to do the clinical part of the studies, and I worked in doing all of that, got qualified. But at the same time, I had met and was continuing to meet and study with some of the very great Tibetan teachers of the particular tradition I followed, the last generation to have their full education and upbringing in Tibet itself. I several times wondered what to do. I sometimes thought, this is so extraordinary, all of these teachings, I would love to sort of do it full time. But my teachers always said, no, you know, it's really good to practice medicine. So I carried on, and I actually did work as a hospital doctor for several years and ended up being a little bit fed up with the sort of university rat race. So I ended up getting a sort of job in Nepal with an NGO that ran services for TB and basic laboratory services in the quite remote mountains. And it was Nepali culture, different from Tibetan culture, but up in the north of where I was working, you know, there were Sherpas and Tibetans and other Buddhist ethnic groups. It was a difficult job as well as being a wonderful one. So I did that for 2 years. But in the meantime, one of the teachers I was involved with was beginning to set up a place in France where people could study and do retreat practice. And I had the invitation to come and take part in a traditional 3-year closed retreat in France.
Yeah.
And so I did that. I was still practicing medicine in a way. I was with a group of 20 people. It was literally a closed retreat. You know, we didn't go out at all for those 3 years, a bit more than 3 years, actually. So I was kind of some use to my fellow retreatants as a doctor. And I had to learn a bit of dentistry as well because people had tooth problems. So that was when we started. As I said, we had a lot of material we were studying and practicing, and we needed to translate it to be able to understand it. When I came out, I actually, again, continued to practice medicine a little bit in the sense that at that point, there were a lot of Tibetans who were coming to France for medical treatment, and you know what was available in India wasn't very good. And I was a kind of interface between the specialists and hospitals in this area and Tibetans who were coming to seek help. But at the same time, I was continuing, you know, the translation and study practice that we were all quite intensely involved with here as a small group. And one of my teachers said, well, practicing medicine is great. Don't forget all about it. It's still useful. But there are quite a lot of doctors. And we can always find them. But there aren't many people studying and translating this material. So perhaps it's good to concentrate on that.
I was just thinking what a relief it would have been for those Tibetan refugees to meet someone who could help them and who understood where they were coming from and who perhaps spoke a language that they could understand. And like, you must have appeared like an angel for these people, like to help them interface with the French medical system.
I don't know whether I appeared like an angel or not, perhaps not all the time. I doubt that would be difficult to keep up, but I did what I could. And in a way, for me, it was very rewarding as well. Some of the people that came for treatment were very accomplished practitioners, meditators, and lamas, and scholars. And it was a privilege to get to know them and to have that, you know, a very potent bridge, if you like, to accompany them in, you know, difficult times sometimes and, you know, in a way quite intimate. I don't know if I was as helpful to them as would have been possible, but they were very helpful to me for sure. And I learned a lot.
Yeah, that just seems actually the most rewarding human relationships are that way, right? We both offer what we have to offer and are rewarded by the other person. So that's really beautiful.
And I think, you know, in a way, it's been very helpful for me for my translation work, because as I said, as translators of this material, we're really in a kind of interface between cultures. And so to have a kind of deep appreciation and understanding of the Tibetan culture and sort of through that sort of more general Buddhist culture, sort of understanding the, you know, the cultural background and the environment. I think when you talk about transmission, it's not just literally what's in the words, but it's trying to convey all of the attitudes and the perspectives and the expectations, cultural expectations and so forth that lie behind them. It's a difficult process.
I once was in France and I was asked to help this director create English subtitles for a French documentary that she had made actually about Algerians during the Algerian War. And I so quickly came up against my limitations, but it was like my brain was on fire the whole time trying to do this translating work. But I also knew that I had to call, like, I had North African friends, you know, I'm seeing this in the language. I don't know what that is. Can you explain that to me? Help me so I can create something for the English subtitle. It was one of those things where I was filled with so much admiration for people who do this on a regular basis. And I thought, they're using every part of their brain, it feels like. But I also kind of wonder, because you're working with texts that are considered sacred, I know you said when you join Buddhism, you're not really asked to believe anything. You don't have to make this leap of faith. But is there ever a sense of confirmation as you translate? Like, oh, I got that right. Or do you ever have that kind of experience?
Oh, definitely, yes. When I said that Buddhism is, in a way, it's kind of recipe, you know, as you go deeper and you get more involved, it comes back to yourself and how you see yourself, how you see your interactions with the world, how you, you know, when you're faced with problems, what you do about it. And I've really found, yes, an extraordinary sense of meaning and depth by, you know, the more I get into these texts, the more I can see from all sorts of different aspects, because they cover a lot of perspectives. The thing is, the Buddha's teachings that you find in the great sutras of the Kanjo are very like, you know, if a teacher was going around nowadays talking to different audiences and explaining, you know, what to do, what's important in life, how to tackle one's emotions, how to deal with difficulties, how to find happiness, all of those kind of things. The way that he or she would talk to different audiences would be very different, and different things would come up. And a lot of the sutras actually record dialogue. The question, people come to the Buddha and they question him. So the Buddha replies to individuals, you know, very often, or he's teaching to a particular group for a particular reason in a particular circumstance, all of which are recorded. Some of the things he says might not be particularly directed at me, or they might be, you know, or they might be directed to people I know or not particularly, you know, and that makes a lot of richness actually, because, you know, everybody finds what seems to resonate for them. You know, there are these different traditions and there are these different philosophical interpretations and different ways of approaching the practice. And I find getting to see, you know, a very full range of these teachings has been really, really interesting.
Is there a passage that you could share with us that has meant a lot to you or has been especially provocative for you?
There are many, of course, but what I'm working on at the moment is this very, very interesting chapter of a big collection of texts in the Kanjo, which is called the Avatamsaka, the Buddha Avatamsaka, which also exists in Chinese. It was translated as the Flower Ornament Scripture. It's a whole category of scriptures, but it's also all one sort of narrative. But the chapter I'm working on actually goes into a fascinating level of detail on what is really meant by a Buddha. And there's this expression, a Tathagata, which is a Sanskrit word meaning somebody who has arrived in suchness, how things really are, the qualities of awakening, the fact that a person embodies awakening, which is a sort of more like a sort of principle or something that's imminent everywhere, is complicated. So how do Buddhas arise and what do they do? What's the nature of their body, their speech, their mind, the way they teach, the way they die, the way people can relate to them? You know, it goes into these sort of 10 topics in great detail using these wonderful metaphors and analogies, a lot of them to do with the weather and clouds and rain and things like that. And it's very inspiring. It's very poetic, but deeply meaningful. And so at the same time, you know, you get from what I've sort of gradually learned and experienced myself trying to practice, trying to understand, trying to reflect on the teachings, on the material, and trying to meditate on it, trying to really sort of realize it and get the perspective that's being recommended, which is a very long process, of course. And I find it very extraordinary to have been exposed to all of this in the Buddha's teachings that have echoes in many of the things that I've been taught or heard about, but give more detail and more confirmation, if you like.
Many thanks to John Conti for speaking with us. This episode was produced by James Sturtevant. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.